There's a promising future for the fat and waste from abattoir and butcher shops. In fact, some are even calling it liquid gold, especially if the industry looks overseas, where a percentage of green or environmentally friendly fuels must be produced in parts of Europe, the US and Canada. Ridley Bestwick from the big Canadian rendering company West Coast Reduction explained to Fiona Breen how the market is evolving.
More recently, Big Oil has entered the biofuel arena. And I think Big Oil for the last 10 or 15 years has sat on the sideline, not knowing whether renewable fuel was something that was just a short-term thing or whether it was here to stay. I think they've concluded it's here to stay now, and as a result, the likes of British Petroleum and Shell and Chevron and Exxon, they're entering into the biofuel manufacture, in effect cutting out the middleman.
Because it takes a lot of money, from what I understand, a big lot of investment. Now, just to clarify, when you're talking about biofuel and the big companies, you are talking about meat render in some of these fuels, aren't you?
I am. The oil refineries can take tallow and use cooking oil, meeting their spec, and they can put it over the same catalyst bed that crude oil goes over. And so they're able to manufacture co-processed biofuels that's completely fungible with the crude diesel. And why it's so attractive in North America is in California, tallow is rated as the most favorable feedstock in terms of having the lowest carbon intensity. So the incentives that the fuel industry receives from co-processed diesel made from tallow is higher than any other feedstock. So to put it into perspective, in California right now, tallow, before the cost of processing it into co-processed diesel, it factors in at about worth at about $1,600 US a metric ton. Now of course you have to deduct off the cost of what the petroleum company has spent to process it and the transportation cost to get it to California, but it's the net result is a much higher price than what tallow is trading at today.
That's sounding pretty good for the rendering business.
It's great for the rendering business.
And does that give your company a good feeling about that for the future?
Well, it certainly does. I mean, today renders in North America supply about 1.6 million metric tons of feedstock to the renewable fuel industry. This expansion that I'm talking about over the next year, if renderers continue to provide that level of feedstock, which is about 21% of the feedstock that renderers produce in North America, they produce roughly 6 million metric tons, that would require another 1.5 million metric tons of feedstock.
You've said yourself it's liquid gold.
It definitely is liquid gold. The tide will rise. And when our company has we're perfectly situated in terms of supplying feedstock to this industry, most of which is in the west coast of the United States. California have very, very, serious carbon reduction programs in place. Washington State, Oregon, and actually British Columbia in Canada is following California in suit. So there's going to be significant demand for feedstock in total, veg oils and tallow, but with tallow being the most preferable feedstock in terms of carbon intensity, the demand from the big oil will be insatiable. I mean, they'll want all the product.
Where do you think Australia fits in?
Australia has, manufactures a lot of tallow. I think that tallow is currently sold into the renewable diesel industry in Singapore, which is Neste Oil. I think the tide will rise in the market price for tallow. So, Australian tallow will continue to be shipped into Neste, or it'll start migrating toward North America, United States or Canada, which will be a first. North America is moving into an importer of tallow because of this renewable fuel industry. So I think Australia is poised well to capture, higher prices for its tallow.
Ridley Bestwick there from Canadian rendering company West Coast Reduction. Well, when abattoirs and butchers prepare our meat products, whether it's lamb, beef, poultry or even fish, there's always a lot of waste or byproducts. There's bones, there's trimmings, all sorts of stuff really. Now, there's a whole industry that renders or turns those byproducts into edible meat products that goes to feed our pets and lots of other things. A lot of Australia's render is in fact exported overseas, most of that to pet food companies. Fiona Breen was at a national rendering conference in Hobart where she spoke with Amy Parker from Elmira Pet Products from Ontario in Canada, who says the rendering industry has really cleaned up its act.
The rendering industry is doing a very good job at cleaning up product, making it just a better quality, more nutritious, taking more care of what they're processing through their plants versus just running volume through.
Well, how's it going in Canada? A lot of organisations or companies have cleaned up their act. What sorts of things have they done to give you a better product?
They have really educated their raw material suppliers and worked with their raw material suppliers in terms of what's going in that bin. So educating your workers, educating the butcher shops, the abattoirs, and they're also doing a better job in terms of what equipment they have in place at their rendering plant, different processes they've implemented. So they're just doing a really good job at cleaning up the product.
Making sure there's no rubbish, really, in the render.
Yes, correct. Yeah.
Because there's that perception, I suppose, or that old perception that the render or the meat products, the waste, is rubbish.
Yes, and people think, oh, it's going to rendering, it's going to garbage. Well, it's not going to garbage. It's a highly nutritional product that ends up being fed to your pet or a fish or an animal of some sort.
There's been a lot of scrutiny on pet food companies and plastics and bits of metal coming up in pet foods. Are we getting away from that?
Oh yeah, very much so. They have made extreme improvements over the last 10 years, I would say even. So the findings on those from our perspective is very minimal.
What sorts of things are your company's pet food makers trying to do to make sure none of those things are in their products?
We have different quality measures in place, so testing, visual inspections on product before it actually comes into our plant, and then we also have quality measures in place on the finished product to ensure that if a mistake happened on the receiving end, that it's not going out into the public. So it would be disposed of, essentially, if we found anything that was contaminated.
Well, you have things like magnets drawing out any potential metal scrap.
Yeah, we have magnets for obviously any metal, but if, magnets don't collect plastic, so that's a visual program.
It's a costly problem if a load of pet food goes out with plastics or metal in it, isn't it? You gave an example of China sending back stuff.
Yeah, and it can be very costly because it's not just the cost of the ingredient that had the plastic in it, it's the cost of the whole pet food diet, the packaging, the transportation, and then you've got to also pay to dispose of it. You can't give it away because if you give it away and it gets out into the market, you're back to your original problem. It's a big cost to people.
Who ends up paying that?
Generally, the suppliers do.
So you'll pass on that cost to the renderers or the suppliers of that renderer?
Yeah, absolutely. We make a claim back to them and hope that you can recover 100% of it.
You talked also about consumer demand, and you were saying that demand for high-quality products for people's pets is really increasing. What sorts of things are they demanding?
A clean food, clean label. Very species-specific on their labels, so instead of generic terms such as poultry and fish, they want to see chicken or turkey. They're expecting good ingredients, a clean label, and just a great food that their dogs love, or cats.
Any particular meats more popular than others?
a lot of meats are different. Really depends on the person buying the food. So they may buy lamb diets because they love the idea of Australia and New Zealand and the grass-fed sheep or the grass-fed lambs.
Now, you mentioned in there, as an aside, there is a small section of the market that is demanding a vegan pet food. Mm-hmm. Where is that at and where do you think it's going?
It is a very, very small part of our business. It's obviously geared towards consumers who are vegans themselves and want to feed their pets vegan. We don't see it as a huge growth part of our business, but we still like to service all consumers if we can.
Are you getting any ingredients from Australia?
Yes, we do. We do about 6,000 to 7,000 metric ton of lamb, and that's out of New Zealand and Australia, and some duck meal.
And how are you finding the quality?
It's great. It's improved over the last 10 years immensely, and the ARA has done a great job at focusing on raw material contamination, foreign material contamination, and just putting a good program in place with the whole industry.
Amy Parker there from Canadian pet food manufacturing company Elmira Pet Products. Well, have you ever eaten a custard apple? Even if you are a devoted fan of the deliciously sweet tropical fruit, it's unlikely you'd have given much thought to how long it would take to breed a successful new commercial variety. Committed Queensland scientists are inching closer to their goal of releasing 4 new varieties, but they told Jennifer Nichols it's such a painstaking process, their quest has already taken 25 years.
Wow, that's really sweet, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah, like we can do a test on it, but yeah, I'd say that's about 22% sugar in that.
That's dessert on a plate there.
It is, yes, beautiful.
Without the guilt factor.
Yep, exactly.
In a shed at the Marucci Research Station, scientists Grant Bignall and Dave Bruin are taste testing the fruits of decades of their labour. The table in front of them is covered with custard apples.
Try that one, Grant.
Yeah.
Just smell that one. We haven't tried this yet.
Yeah. Well, I love the flavour of that one.
And better when they're not flesh is not so cold, room temperature.
It's a lot juicier, that one.
I actually prefer that to the...
Well, that's our next one, we hope, to come full-scale elite testing in orchards.
Yeah.
Grant Bignall, we're looking at a table full of custard apples, and what a variety, different shapes and colours.
Yes, these are all our progeny lines that we're assessing at the moment. We've got dark reds, light reds, in between, some green as well. So there is quite a variety that we assess on a day-to-day basis here.
For people who aren't really familiar with custard apples, I am, because my mum absolutely loved them, so she would always grow them. What would you describe the flavour as?
Oh, look, it's a very tropical flavour, rich, creamy taste. Feels like it's a bit of a treat when you're eating it because it's so sweet. We're seeing some different flavours coming out of the breeding project as well because of some of the species we're bringing in to bring in those red flavours. We're getting a really tangy flavour, a lolly flavour in some of them as well. We're really focusing on a piece of fruit with excellent eating characteristics as well as high yields and large size. And large size is really something that people are sought after, especially for export.
So this one's purple.
This is purple, a darker red than what the industry's looking for. So this is not quite ripe. It was a little bit crunchy, but as you can see, the real red internal flesh of the one that we've just cut open. The real point of difference with this is the skin colour, but there's also some different eating characteristics with it. The flesh is a little bit different. It's a bit of a firmer flesh. So when you eat a normal custard apple, you usually ended up with hands full of sticky juice. But this is a much firmer flesh, not quite as juicy, and a little bit of a different flavour as well. So we've just cut open one of the red skin selections, and you can see while it's red outside, none of that red is coming into the flesh of the fruit. So you can see it's a nice bright white flesh inside, so it's very similar to the normal green skin custard apples that we have on the market at the moment.
Some of these look more like a pine cone almost in their shape.
Yeah, so a lot of the stuff that comes out of the breeding work isn't all attractive stuff. We get some really ugly shapes, like you can see one down the end there just looks like a big mess of grapes, but other times we see some beautiful shapes and some beautiful colours out. It's sometimes the luck of the draw when you're in the breeding project. So.
And the gorgeous red variety that you've been working on, wow, that would be really popular in Asia, I imagine.
Definitely, yeah, people's eyes light up when they see the red custard apple. Definitely has potential for the Asian markets, for sure.
So what goes into breeding custard apples?
Well, a lot of hard work, actually. A lot of time and hard work.
Dave Bruin, you have been here for the long haul.
Yes.
25 years researching custard apples. Wow.
Maybe 30, knocking 30, but wow. The breeding program, I think, is 25 years.
How satisfied are you with the sorts of fruit that you're producing now?
Excellent. Years ago, a lot of fruit just tasted horrible. And you get the odd good one. Now we're consistently good tasting, good characteristics, and yeah, it's a happening thing.
So Grant Bignall, this is almost like the search for the Holy Grail. I mean, 25 years without actually getting a successful new custard apple variety out there. It's just incredible.
Yeah, it takes a long time. Any tree crop, it's a long drawn out process breeding. So just to give you an idea of the stages that make up those 20 odd years to getting a variety out, from when we make the initial cross, we've got 3 to 4 years before we initially see those as a new plant. So after those 4 years, we'll propagate those. They go out onto small scale testing out on multiple regions, and then we'll evaluate those for probably another 5 years before we make a decision to put them out to a large scale testing. So that's more of a commercial test where they're going out into orchard in bigger numbers. So once they go into that large scale testing scheme, we wait probably another 5 to 6 years before we make a real decision on if they go to a commercial release or not. From making the initial cross to selecting it, there's still a huge process in front of us to make sure that they're suitable for all growing regions.
And you did put one variety out there, but it wasn't commercially accepted everywhere. It's growing really well at the Glasshouse Mountains, but not widespread enough, that trial.
Yeah, I mean, that's a perfect example of why we need to test in all the different regions. So Marucci Gold went out years ago. It's a beautiful piece of fruit, but for Queensland only, it didn't really perform in northern New South Wales, where a lot of the industry is based as well. So, you know, what we're doing now is making sure that when we release something, it's suitable for all regions.
So how many varieties are you inching closer to being able to release?
Well, I think we're getting really close to have 3 new greenskin varieties ready in the next 2 to 3 years. So 2 of those are fairly similar to each other, very similar to the industry standard, but we do have another one that is quite a bit different, tastes quite a bit different as well. So they're just pushing their way into the end of their large-scale testing. So we're getting some data on those to see if they tick the boxes to go forward and be commercialised.
So close.
Getting very close, yes, it's getting a bit exciting. So, yeah, a bit further away for the redskin, but yeah, we've really focused our efforts in the last probably 5 to 6 years on the redskin variety. So in those next 3 years, we're hoping we'll have something exciting as well.
Grant Bignall there, the Senior Research Scientist at Queensland's Department of Agriculture, Marucci Research Station.